movie of gorgeous women is always assuaged by the belief that they'll come to a bad end. Welcome to Envy, the semi-final in our Seven Deadly Sins series on the spirit of things. I'm Rachel Kahn. You're tuned to Radio National, abc.net.au/rn.
Donna Wanna, she's a creature of passion. She's a problem child with an eye for fashion. She'll select and reject. She's really rather fussy. She so wants to be happy with a dash of fame and power. She's so intense.
Yes, envy drives the fashion world. But it isn't just a fashion game. It's a professional sport, a class struggle, and a biological urge. I assembled three experts, a fashion editor, a journalist, and a theologian, who were prepared to talk to me about envy.
Everything is so unsure. Failure could be at the door. Is she making progress or not?
Hello and welcome to a discussion on envy, the sin that's no fun at all. It's also the human tendency we don't like to admit, even to ourselves. Well, healthy admiration can make us do better. Envy comes from a deep unhappiness within ourselves and with ourselves. Well, among the key players in our culture where envy can be a trap are popular women's magazines, New Age Spirituality, which is a multi-billion dollar business, and gender politics. Our envy specialists this week are Jackie Frank, editor of Mary Claire magazine, and she's here in Sydney with me. And Steve Salerno, who wrote Sham, How the Self-Help and Actualization Movement is Making America Helpless, joins us from Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, that is. And Joseph Gelfer, specialist in religion and gender issues. He's the author of Old Men, New Men, and he's in our Melbourne ABC studio. Welcome to you all.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, Jackie, I'd like to start with you, because when it comes to envy, I think young women are usually seething with it. It's usually the conversation in high school halls. It fuels gossip. Is girl envy still focused on beauty?
There's no denying that beauty plays a role in women's consciousness and in the way that they view each other. You know, we strive to feel and look beautiful, and that can cause some anxiety, especially in young girls who don't quite understand it. Envy, such a strong word that has such negative connotations to it. And we were actually discussing whether envy or jealousy, you know, where do you draw the line, where the difference is between the two? Is it mainly focused on beauty? I don't think that it is limited to beauty. I think it extends across different facets of a woman's life, whether it be her romantic or her professional relationships. We did a story called Frenvy.
Frenvy?
We did a story on
Frenvy. That's a new word.
Well, you know, we've got a word for everything now, don't we? Women's magazines, we have to.
Yes.
But it was looking at two best friends and how their relationship and where envy actually entered to their relationship. And it was about professional jealousies on one side. And on the other side, it was about a girl who had the partner and the child, and the other one had the career, and they envied each other's lives.
I certainly think that professional envy is something we'll get to later on in our conversation.
Sorry.
But it certainly is all about how people live and how they look. I often think that because magazines are now so commonly using Photoshop to make sure their images are absolutely perfect, like a Grecian statue, I wonder whether most of us are condemned to perpetual envy of the beauty that is there.
You know what? I think people are actually rebelling against that, and people have an understanding that there is digital retouching. Children, my 11-year-old son goes on the computer and digitally enhances and changes our family photos, not to make us look slimmer, but to do funny things to them. And there's been so much in the press and so much publicity about that, that I don't know if I agree with you so much on that level.
Well, I wonder whether the article in Mary Claire in the November issue was a way of addressing that. It was an interesting one about women, a whole lot of them, who were shown naked, except their heads were not there, And what it was about was how women felt about their bodies. And about 80% of them were unhappy with their bodies.
Well, the statistic, it was in response to a survey we did, and it said that 12% were happy with their bodies, which meant 88% of women, and we polled over 5,000 women, said they were not happy with their bodies. And the article you're referring to was taking a group of women and asking them to talk about it. And yes, it's really alarming. And what's really interesting, actually, too, is that it's about women judging themselves against another woman. So, you know, men are saying, you look beautiful. We don't care what men are saying, which is ridiculous because they're the ones who are admiring our bodies, who we have a relationship with. I mean, it's the men that we have the physical, sexual relationship with, but it's about other women.
Yes.
So it's really quite interesting. If we only took a minute to say we are gorgeous and take that on board from what men give us, who find us sexually attractive, we'd be a much better place.
Well, that's so interesting. Steve Salerno, when it comes to unhappiness with ourselves, there's nothing quite like the New Age movement to provide every kind of remedy, is there? So how big is that industry?
Well, it's recently been tracked as an $11 billion industry, and I think it's interesting that when you look at the fact that practically every other industry here in America is collapsing and needs a bailout, self-help is the one industry that's still growing at enviable double-digit rates, or at least 5.5% last year when nobody was spending money on anything else. They were spending money on self-help. If I may, though, could I go back to one point that your other guest made? I think that the intellectual awareness that we live in a digital age and that photos can be retouched is very different from the emotional impact that those images send, the messages they send. And I frankly think it's a little bit disingenuous to have a category of magazines. And I'm speaking, I have no knowledge of women's magazines in Australia, for example, but I know here in America, I've studied and written about this at some length. You have a whole category of magazines that was founded allegedly to celebrate women and to celebrate the diversity of beauty, and yet it's the same image that comes at us from the cover every single month. And not only are the models like 11 pounds to begin with, but then they're photoshopped to be even smaller. So I don't think that you can separate out the you have to separate out the intellectual content of a magazine from the very potent imagery that is put forth into the culture that becomes a message, an ethos of this is the way beauty is supposed to look.
I'd just like to tell you that the images that we were referring to were real women, and there was more than 16 of them in all different shapes and sizes, with no retouching, with just exposed. They obviously didn't have their faces because they were talking quite honestly about their bodies. So I think that was a celebration of the diversity of women.
But it did contrast, I think. It was in high relief to what we are used to when we open up a magazine and we almost want to be assailed with these gorgeous images that we hope somehow to become. But Steve, I wanted to explore a little more deeply about the self-help and actualization movement, because it's pretty clear that the motivation for these self-improvement courses is actually this feeling of inferiority. So are the clientele actually feeling envious of the gurus who they follow?
Well, I think that the gurus put out this message that you too can be like me if you only follow the methods that I preach and pay me, you know, $9,600 for it, as was the case in that recent tragedy, which I'm sure you heard about, the people who died here in the Sweat Lodge incident out in Arizona. But the overriding message is you have for a generation now, self-help has been telling people you're empowered. You can do anything you want. There are no limits. Be all you can be. And I think when a person has been consuming this kind of message for years and years, and then you go out into the real world and you discover, you know what, I can't have everything I want. I can't look exactly the way I want to. And how come my friend Joe got that beautiful woman and I have to settle for someone who's not quite as attractive? Naturally, you're going to have envy because what self-help has done in a nutshell, it's raised a generation of narcissists. We see this in some of the studies that track the way college students feel about them and the way they relate to other students. The prevailing attitude is, I want, where's mine? And I don't want to have to wait for it.
Yes, and it's all about me. I want what she's having. I'm always
exactly.
impressed. I'm always impressed by how sleek, sassy, and good-looking the New Age gurus are. But it must be
right.
it must be pretty difficult to keep up that image of perfection. I can think of one very well-known guru of well-being who's had quite a few facelifts.
I don't think that that's unique to one guru. I mean, these people make a ton of money, and their persona is what they are. The way they come across is who they are. And the only person I can think of who really has been able to get away with not being like that is Dr. Phil. And he kind of has this avuncular, everybody's cousin Jack image that he puts out. He's the guy who tells you straight, and that works for him. Women like that. He's like the big teddy bear. But you're right. A lot of the other gurus put a lot of time and energy into looking the part.
Yeah. Well, Joseph, I'd like to bring you in here, because when it comes to envy, my sense is that men are even less likely to admit it, but just as prone to act on it. Isn't envy pretty much why Cain kills Abel in the Bible, the first recorded murder?
Well, absolutely. I mean, envy goes even further back than that, really. I mean, you only have to look at the legend of Satan, for example, who was originally an angel, but it was his envy of God that caused him to rebel, for which he was cast out of heaven in the first place to hell. Satan's envy of God and the hatred for him that this caused that went and led him to tempt Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden to sin. So in part, envy is responsible not just for the first murder of Cain and Abel, but for the fall of humanity in the first place. But as you rightly noted with the Cain and Abel story, I mean, Abel keeps flocks and Cain works the soil, and Cain takes some of the fruits of his working, the soil, and offers them to God, and Abel turns and offers his fat portions from the firstborn of his flock, and God looks favourably upon Abel's offering, but less so on Cain's, and as you say, takes him out into the field and kills him as a result. But the interesting thing to remember here, it's not that God doesn't expect Cain not to feel envy, simply that he has to learn how to deal with it. So he says to him, you know, sin's crouching at your door. It desires to have you, but you've got to master it. He doesn't deal with it, and as a result, he's banished, a fugitive and wanderer of the earth.
Well, you've written about contemporary masculine spirituality, and I would think that the Cain and Abel story is right at the foundation. How much do you think the patriarchal tendency in religion is perpetuated by men measuring themselves against other men, but totally excluding women from the exercise?
Well, I mean, one of the aspects that psychologists have noticed about the phenomenon of envy is that we tend to be envious of people that are similar to ourselves. And it's those people that we are competing with that we tend to be envious of. And in many ways, within the kind of the regular public sphere of work, it's other men that men are competing with. The little sayings that always makes me chuckle is that of Gore Vidal, of every time a friend succeeds, a small part of me dies. I mean, I can certainly appreciate that. It's why ambitious people particularly suffer from envy. They're always looking out for other people's achievements. But, I think envy is very much built into the masculine mode, but particularly within men. And they don't look so much to women, because the whole part of patriarchy and hegemonic masculinity of different types of men coming together and controlling one another and forming different power relations is based around the fact that it's a masculine economy in the first place, and that women don't really have that much of a position within it.
Except, of course, as the prize. And I'm thinking here of the famous story of Oedipus, the son envying the father for his access to the mother.
Sure, I mean, I'm not really sure what to say about that.
Well, I guess, excuse me, I guess that would be the, one of those foundation stories where envy is a deeply sexual, if not gendered, kind of complex that is built into the family.
But there was a study published in Science that looked at the brain using an MRI and found the experience of envy of another person's success activates a pain pathway to the brain. So it actually, literally, is a painful emotion.
Indeed.
And the pain response is like a red flag to tell people this is not good, to get out of there. So it's interesting that you say that envy can be used in a good way as well as in a negative way.
Can I just jump in here about the masculine envy aspect? I worked for a time at Men's Health Magazine. Prior to Men's Health Magazine, most of the other men's magazines like Esquire, even Playboy, there was this sense that they were talking to one homologous fraternity of men who were all after the same thing together, almost like the Pure commercials. Everybody's patting each other on the back and they're all best buddies. With the advent of Men's Health and using cover models, for example, that had the six-pack abs and running features that did indeed directly address this competition, like that guy next door is not necessarily your buddy, he's also your competitor. It's interesting that Men's Health was able to very quickly, in magazine terms, rise to the top of the heap or near the top of the heap and surpass some of the other magazines because they addressed that feeling very directly that, you know, let's put all this buddy crap aside and let's be honest about this. We're all after everybody else's stuff and we're going to tell you how to get it. And it doesn't say that directly, but clearly that's the meta message of the magazine.
Well, that actually ties in quite clearly to the kind of evolutionary theory, in as much as the biological deterministic fact of it and how we're bound by it, is that envy is some kind of psychological trigger in resource competition. And this is actually another one of the reasons in this evolutionary thinking why we tend not to articulate envy so much. It's not so much because it's embarrassing, but by voicing those feelings of envy, it's announcing that you've been outperformed and exposes in some way any strategic attempts to secure more resources in the survival of the fittest.
The biological basis of envy, one of the seven deadly sins that lends a greenish hue to just about everyone at some time or another. Joseph Gelfer is the editor of the online Journal of Men, Masculinities and Spirituality. Steve Salerno writes for the Wall Street Journal, and Jackie Frank is the editor of Mary Claire Magazine Australia. You're tuned to Radio National, abc.net.au/rn, and this is The Spirit of Things. Well, Jackie, I want to take up the point of biological determinism because you're a mother, and I'm fully aware that envy can start very early on in the family situation where the first child comes and has the full attention of the parents, then the second child comes and bumps the first one aside. Then sometimes a third and fourth come along, and all of them vying for the attentions of the parents as well as each other. Is envy, therefore, sort of hardwired? Is it hard to avoid?
Oh, especially when you're talking about children. I think the primal response of wanting your parent and having your parent 100% and then having another child who takes away, is it survival? Is it envy? You know what I mean? It's sort of, I resist to think that children are hardwired for envy. And I think that if parents then, it's up to the role of the parent to really put it out there and address it openly about the feelings and allow their children, I think actually this is quite a good point, allow their children to express their feelings to then respond to their feelings, you can remove that feeling instantly. So it's up to the parent again in its role to protect the child from something that's so negative.
Yes, but I guess it's pretty instinctive almost.
Is it survival or is it envy?
Well, it can sometimes generate resentment. I mean, envy is about resenting the success and what the other person has. So a child immediately resents the
attention of the other.
And it can easily turn to hatred or anger.
Anger is a natural response, and anger is something, if dealt with, can be diffused. Whereas if something's just hardwired, I'm not sure that it can. It means it's always going to keep raising itself, whereas I'm not sure. I would hate to believe that.
Jackie, do you think we've evolved past the kind of family structures that Jane Austen wrote about, where girls envied the advantages that their brothers received?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we've moved beyond both parents, or even the family structure is so different in every single way. There's no classic family structure anymore. And I think that girls have evolved so much. We have developed, we have our independence, you know, we're not struggling for those things anymore. The one thing that I do believe boys have that girls don't have, that girls still fight with, is this, what I call the reckless abandonment. Boys can just, you know, girls are always expected to look pretty and well-groomed, and whereas boys, you know, the hair disheveled, the shirts out, and that's, you know, they have this freedom that girls are starting to embrace, actually. But your parents would tell you, no, you've got to change that.
Well, I want to ask you about how far they've embraced that, because I've always wondered whether the current concept of beauty is driven by girls envying boys, so making themselves look like boys, wearing their underdacks, flattening their chest, losing their hips, and boys possibly envying the fashion indulgences of girls, so they look and dress more like girls, more fastidious about the way they look, putting on more cologne, making sure they have, you know, their facial massages. Is there some envy going on back and forth and some trading?
I just think the lines are being blurred. I don't necessarily associate it again with envy. The lines are being blurred. Anything goes. Whatever makes you feel good is what people are pursuing today. And it goes back to the point of the younger generation, I want, I want, I want. And they have no boundaries and they have no constraints on them. And I think what you're talking about is more that, in exploring other vehicles. But mainstream, I don't agree with the girls being boys and the boys being girls, but I think that there's a section of the population that likes to experiment, and in today's world, anything goes.
Steve, would you like to comment on that?
Well, I think that the point that was raised about the anger, Roy Baumeister, who is a leading psychologist here in the U.S., I believe he's at Florida State now, has done some very interesting studies that go to this point of the issue of whether envy is hardwired. And his work seems to show that whether it's hardwired or not, I don't think that we do ourselves any good by stoking it and inflaming it, because the self-esteem movement, I mean, I'm addressing that primarily because that's my area of expertise that I bring to this, but for 40 years in this country, we put out this message that you're special, you're great, you're wonderful. And what Roy Baumeister has observed in his studies is that when people learn that they can't quite have what they want, it produces a lot of rage. And counterintuitively, the highest measured levels of self-esteem, like people always think that when you feel bad about yourself is low self-esteem, you know, that we have to coddle these people some more. But Baumeister's studies show that the highest measured levels of self-esteem are in serial killers, drug runners, and people of that level. The point being that when you tell people that they can have anything they want, they're going to find a way of doing it, even if it isn't always legal, and even if it involves these explosions of rage that result in some you know, really antisocial acts. So when we say, you know, is envy a good thing, I think we have to distinguish between envy and healthy competition. I think there's a difference, and I think envy has to be or should be looked at as a very dangerous emotion.
Mm. Well, the whole male-female battle of the sexes in the New Age movement, I think, would have some ramifications. Is that what's behind women wanting, most of all, to be empowered? It's power and control that they so want.
Yeah, I think if you watch the Oprah Winfrey show, the word empowerment or some variant of it is used 67 times in every single show. This is reactionary. I mean, what this is, when Oprah came along, women were still trying to find themselves in America, and there was a lot of revisionism going on. We had that first wave of women's rights. And then that, too, ran up against this wall, like, well, wait a minute, if I want my rights, that means I have to leave my children in daycare, and maybe that's not such a good thing. So you had a lot of people struggling for self-definition or gender definition, and then Oprah came along and kept singing about empowerment, and, you know, that almost becomes a mantra. But again, to me, that seems empty. That doesn't seem to solve anything, because the fact is, just repeating every day, I am special, I am empowered, is not going to change the fact that maybe you don't get along with your husband, that you have to put the kids in daycare, that between the two of you, you just barely make enough money to get by. I mean, it's a lot of empty rhetoric, the way I look at it. And I know maybe that doesn't address the issue of envy too much, but certainly I don't think self-help has solved the battle of the sexes at all.
But I'd like to respond to you saying that women are looking for power. In our survey, and we just surveyed over 5,000 Australian women, 75% of women believe that a happy family life and a good relationship define success in their life. So I would actually argue that women aren't looking for power, and especially the younger ones, they see everybody having to fight for it, and they've seen, you know, have it all. They believe they can have it all. They don't actually want it all at the same time, and they are putting their personal life ahead of their careers, which is very different because in the past people saw career as power, and I don't think women are actually coveting power as much as it's self-empowerment. Which is different.
Yeah, well, I think we were talking about self-empowerment. Steve, one way of feeling self-empowered is delighting in another person's failure, otherwise known as Schadenfreude, of course. There must be a big ripple of that going around in the New Age fraternity of gurus with the tragic consequences of James Arthur Ray's Sweat Lodge, which you previously mentioned.
Well, if you notice, they've been conspicuous by their silence. I don't think that I've seen a quote from one major guru because they're terrified right now, because it seems that for the first time, I just did a piece about this in the Wall Street Journal the other day that's gotten a tremendous amount of response and all kinds of personal anecdotes from people who went through these training sessions. But the bubble has burst. You know, before, the worst thing that you could say about self-help was that it was frivolous, and that it wasted a lot of money, it wasted a lot of time, it created concepts like codependency that only seemed to drive people apart instead of together. But now people are dying, and I think that's focused the light on, you know, exactly who's selling these regimens. Have they ever been tested? Do they make sense? Are they internally consistent? And the answers to a lot of these questions are no. And I think what the gurus are doing, frankly, is they're running as far and as fast as they can. They're all trying to differentiate themselves as much as possible from James Ray. And if you look at their websites, they've even changed a lot of their marketing material in the last weeks or so because they want to be as disidentified as possible from what he's doing.
Joseph, you're an explorer of men's spiritualities. Well, men's sweat lodges must have come into your purview.
Well, absolutely. I just wanted to pick up on that, as Steve was saying, actually. I'm not sure that the New Age movement of past has been quite that benign. I mean, we have to remember here that the thing with the sweat lodge, it was a spiritual warrior event. And this is something that I write quite a bit about in terms of masculine spirituality, this appeal to the warrior archetype. And while it wasn't a men's retreat as such at that sweat lodge, it does resonate, as you say, quite clearly with the way that the men's movement has worked since Robert Bly did Iron John back in 1990. And what that tends to do is it actually has a very damaging effect on everyone, because by appealing to the warrior archetype, or another one, big popular one at the time was the king archetype, is it promotes a certain type of way of doing masculinity, of being a man, that suggests that somehow you have to revert to this kind of inner combative way of doing masculinity. And that's damaging both for men who are involved in it, and it's damaging for the women that are in their lives. I mean, I'm surprised that there hasn't been more problems of this kind in the past, and it's taken this long to get to these tragic deaths in Sedona, especially when we look at the Mankind Project, which has been doing these new warrior training weekends for 15, 20 years or whatever. I think it was a sadly predictable and overdue event.
Yes, well, it happened.
And I also, I have to say that I agree very much about it. It appeals to the worst masculine archetypes.
Absolutely.
These events are all about bullying. They're about intimidation. They're about forcing people to sit down, stand up, take your clothes off, and I'm not exaggerating. And I agree wholeheartedly that it is astonishing to me that there haven't been far more serious repercussions psychologically from some of these things in the past.
Well, probably people still envy the people who sail through it, the men who run across hot coals. I mean, executives are still doing those things in order to come out the winner.
Well, I think you're right. I think envy has a lot to say about this. I mean, if we look at James Arthur Ray and the way that he's promoted the law of attraction in The Secret and so forth, is that a lot of the thinking behind that is this envy towards people that have stuff that we want. And we kind of think that somehow, you know, we put these positive thoughts and vibes out there that we're going to get this stuff. But the problem is, and this is another little form of envy that I want to work in here, about class envy. And one of the reasons that the law of attraction is so particularly unsavoury is it completely glosses over the fact that there are all sorts of reasons why people can feel envy within society. It kind of assumes that we live in this some kind of genuine meritocracy and that all you've got to do is think positively and attract wealth. But it doesn't work like that. And one of the reasons that envy often works in society is because there are inequities in place. But people have stuff not necessarily because they deserve it, but perhaps because they've had certain privileges in education, because they know the right people. And of course, sometimes people just work hard well, of course. But I think class envy is something that needs to be brought back onto the table a lot more these days.
Wasn't Marx trying to get rid of that by making everyone equally poor? I mean, some people would say that Marx envied the people who had so much that he wanted to ensure that no one ever had that much again.
I think that's a rather simplistic understanding of Marx. I mean, and I don't even think we need to think of class envy within a Marxist framework. I think we can talk about it in terms of privilege and the way that capital and just opportunity is dispersed within society. And that's one of the kind of, you know, unfortunate things about the law of attraction, is it kind of assumes that these things don't actually exist. Inequity is something to do with our own personal shortcomings. But there's much more than that. The shortcomings are society-wide, not just down to the individual.
Well, that society versus the individual really came out in the James Ray debacle, because he was telling everyone, in the midst of people dying and being injured, he was telling everyone to stay focused on themselves. Don't bother helping anyone else. This seems to be the bottom line of envy. It's all about me.
Maybe, but I've got another way of thinking about it, actually. And this for me is the kind of the spiritual takeaway of this whole discussion, really, is that while ostensibly it can seem that envy is about me, what it's actually really about is absence and lacking. It's about seeking something. It's kind of like a confused attempt to search for meaning, presence and completeness, I think, in the face of what it's basically just an existential ultimate concern of meaninglessness. I mean, in short, I suppose it envies the search for meaning in all the wrong places.
She's learning at last how to listen. She's learning some useful inhibitions. And bit by bit she starts to see the joy of being ordinary. What a gigantic relief. Ah, she's so intelligent, but that's irrelevant. And being highly strung, never furthered anyone. Her life is still heroic, although it looks prosaic. She's terminally a bit like you and me.
That cheeky song is by Bronwyn Calcutt from her new CD, Songs of Six Realms, an interpretation of the Tibetan Wheel of Life. Jackie Frank, editor of Mary Claire magazine, Joseph Gelfer, author of Old Men, New Men, spelt N-U-M-E-N, and Steve Salerno, author of Sham, How the Gurus of the Self-Help Movement Make Us Helpless, are my guests on The Spirit of Things on Radio National. We are discussing envy, the sin that's no fun, except for rare moments. Jackie, I have to say that one of the most deliciously decadent parts of women's magazines are the photos of top celebrities looking their worst. You know, they've got a bad hair day, bad dress sense, you know, they've let their waistline go. It's taking them down a peg. Mm. Is this just a bad case of schadenfreude, or is this sort of helping us with our celebrity envy?
In Australia, I call it the tall poppy syndrome. Absolutely, it is. It's all about, we put these celebrities on such pedestals and we say that it's unrealistic and it's unattainable. So to see them fall from grace like that is fantastic. And it is driven by the whole idea and concept of they're perfect, we can never be like them, and we envy their lives. They've got everything, the money, the fame, all the trappings that young people today see as being successful as well.
Jackie, as editor of Mary Claire, you must be hugely envied, given the popularity of The Devil Wears Prada and the feature your film, the September issue about the Vogue editor, Anna Wintour.
Oh, I don't think anyone would envy that.
but your job is downright glamorous. I would have thought that loads of young women want what you have.
They have very little understanding of what the job is. It's, as you know, it's hard work. It's dealing with people. Look, people have a fantasy about what a magazine editor does. And I think that the September issue showed one particular type of person, and The Devil Wears Prada was on the same person. I don't think people would envy her after seeing that, because she came across as purely miserable. People envied the fashion director, Grace Connington, the creative director, who had a joie de vivre about life. So I think it demystified magazines in a certain way.
Does envy manifest around you? I mean, have you experienced it? Do you sense it?
I've been very lucky with the people that I work with, very strong people with very high self-esteem. So they don't envy me. They actually sometimes pity me for all the things that I have to do. And being a mother as well as, you know, a working mother, I suffer from the same work-life balance as any other person who works anywhere else. It's just that I have a more of a profiled position.
Mm. If I could just jump in here.
Indeed.
But one of the things that we've been talking here about is that somehow envy is purely to do with me as an individual feeling envy. But of course, it's also got something to do, as you're suggesting, with the people who are the object of envy. And this is why in a lot of cultures we've got the folklore of the evil eye, because it is referring very much to the harm that can be done to people when they're looked upon with the envious evil eye.
By the way, Jackie just rolled up her sleeve and showed me she's wearing an evil eye.
Well, there you
yes,
go.
But I come from, my background is Middle Eastern in one
sure.
way, and evil eye has been placed on us forever.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, that it's there, of course, you know, and becomes part of those cultural habits of avoiding ostentatious displays of wealth, of boasting about achievements and flaunting physical beauty. And I think even in I've read somewhere, I'm not even sure if this is true, but in some Middle Eastern cultures where boys are more prized than girls, that the boys are somehow dressed up as girls to stop that envious evil eye looking upon the family.
Gosh, Steve, I would think that boasting about your wealth is the core of a lot of the self-help movement courses that you've looked at.
Yeah, well, there's this concept that wealth is reproducible, that success is reproducible almost by osmosis or simply by being in the same room with other people who are successful. I don't know where the foundation is for that logically, but I do know that it resonates. The irony of this, and in a perverse way, it's really masterful, is that you have a guru who becomes wealthy by inducing people who often don't have the money to pay $5,000 to come and hear him speak and give a lecture on how to become wealthy. I mean, is that deliciously perverse, or is there any other way to say it? One other quick point I wanted to touch on. Speaking about the wider sense of class envy, I don't think that any politician, at least in recent memory, has appealed to class envy as masterfully as Barack Obama did in the last election cycle here. Now, I voted for the guy. I mean, I was very high on him, and I was very open about this on my blog. And, of course, he happened to come along at a time when America was ripe for it. But the funny thing is, Oprah gave him a copy of The Secret very early in his campaign trail. And he may not have used the word empowerment in a lot of the buzzwords, but he did use a lot of these sorts of seductive concepts that kind of get in underneath the radar, and he was extremely successful in stoking this mood of 5% of America has what you want. They've got your money. And, you know, we really had an extremely envious climate in this last election cycle.
Well, what about Barack Obama? I mean, a lot of people envied him right at the beginning. They still do. So his luster is still there.
Well, luster is a funny word. I would say he is still definitely the most magnetic figure in America. The question is whether he's magnetic good or magnetic bad. I mean, he's a lightning rod for all kinds of criticism, you know, as we see now. But again, he brings some of this on himself. I mean, I don't know any other president in recent memory who did commercial promos for sitcoms, which he's doing now, too. I mean, you talk about a man of the people. He's a man of the people. But,
wow.
Yes, you're definitely right. There's an awful lot of envy, and I think there's, of course, the racial aspect of it, too.
Well, he wouldn't last that long in Australia because we've got the tall poppy syndrome, which makes sure that anyone who sticks out too far above the crowd, you know, gets a swift kick in the rear and loses his luster pretty quickly. What about that, Joseph? I mean, the tall poppy syndrome in academia, where you ply your trade, it's pretty severe there, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, but, you know, obviously it's always painful to see other people doing well when we're not, or, you know, at least not as well as we feel we should be doing. But I think the tall poppy syndrome has got something to do with thinking of success as a zero-sum game, and that somehow someone else's success has to come at the expense of my own. And obviously it's not necessarily the case of that. But I don't want to disappoint you by being too much of a Marxist, but I want to bring it back to class in some ways. I think sometimes the tall poppy syndrome has got to do with the fact that there are lots of social inequities around, and that it's something that the common person can do to just get back at somebody who's managed to leverage on some of the privilege that they have, rightly or wrongly, on both the part of the small person and the part of the tall poppy.
But in the socialist ethos, which I think pretty much dominates academia, no one...
Not anymore.
Not
maybe
anymore.
Back in the 70s.
Maybe in the 70s. I'm in a time warp. There is a strong sense that no one should be more successful than anyone else.
But you're assuming that somehow that draws everyone down to the lowest common denominator. I think in an ideal world, that rises everybody up to the highest.
Steve, I wonder whether the self-help and actualization movement, which you've dubbed sham, is the reverse of that, selling the illusion that everyone can be a tall poppy, even when that isn't really likely in a society where there are winners and losers.
You know, the funny thing is, it's such a check-your-brains-at-the-door phenomenon. I went to a real estate training seminar when I was doing the research for sham. Now, this consisted of 250 salespeople from the same firm. That's important. The guru who was leading this workshop implied strongly that every single one of them could be the number one salesman in the firm next year, and they all stood up and applauded. Now, obviously, that's logically impossible, but this is what I mean. It sells this idea like The Secret, that all of life, there is no zero sum to any of it, that all of life and all of the universe is at our disposal if we simply reorganize our thoughts and ask for it nicely. And obviously, that's an appealing message, but it's also a ridiculous message and potentially a dangerous message when it's applied, for example, in a medical setting, and you dissuade people from having conventional, orthodox, proven treatment and instead push them towards what you might call wishful thinking type treatment. So there is a lot of danger here. Even though we laugh about it, it can be very potent stuff.
Well, true confession time here. Jackie, who do you envy most and why?
I envy the woman when I'm driving to work that I see is driving the other way down the road, obviously going to the gym or for coffee and, you know, her hair's beautifully manicured, you know, everything's looking beautiful and she's in the big Range Rover and she looks like she's got not a care in the world and I'm trying to get through traffic to get to work.
Right. That's pretty good. Joseph, who do you envy?
Oh, it's a very difficult question. I mean, I think in some ways I envy the kind of people that that are interested and buy into the law of attraction and The Secret, because that's one of the things I find so frustrating, and I'm sure Stephen has a very much similar experience, is that, you know, in my work I try and expose the nonsense behind a lot of this kind of stuff. And even though I have what feels to me like watertight arguments as to why what's happening, it must be completely rejected, everyone just kind of looks to be glass-eyed and just buys into it. And I'd like to have some without faith in the law of attraction, I think.
Yes. Well, Steve, is there at least one guru that you admire? I mean, are there times where you secretly would like to be Dr. Phil?
Oh, God help us, no. No. If I can be honest, I don't know how well baseball is followed over there, but I wouldn't mind being Alex Rodriguez, who is an American baseball player. He makes $78,000 for every single game he plays. He loves what he's doing. He's allowed to play a little boy's game. and has all of these accolades and all of this success and a wonderful life and is paid handsomely. And I guess envy is too strong a word, but I wouldn't mind being A-Rod for a little while.
Yeah, well, I must say, having to move office this week, I envy the non-hoarders.
Yeah.
I think I need a front-end loader.
Do that. You can be a non-hoarder.
Steve, you must know at least one course that'll teach me how not to hoard.
A 12-step or something?
A 12-step or 7-step. I've got so many books at the moment which are called 7 Steps 2.
So I think something. Oprah's got a declutter on her show. So.
Oh, declutter.
Seven steps to the rubbish bin.
Wouldn't you think by now that some of those steps would have taken, though? I mean, if there really were just 7 steps, wouldn't you have learned them by now?
The first 7 steps of life. Steve,
could I just make a quick point about just harking back to the whole kind of thing of gender and envy that we started off with? 2/3 of people who go to church are women, and I think that goes up to about 80% during the week. One of the things that's occurred to me, just within the context of this discussion, is that there might actually be some kind of gender envy going on from the point of view of men, in as much as that women are generally assumed to have some kind of innate religiosity and spirituality that is absent in men. And I wonder sometimes if this kind of pathological assertion of masculinity that we often see in spiritualities which define themselves as masculine, i.e. those kind of spiritual warrior events and so forth, is some kind of subconscious response to an envy of wanting to be able to appear religious when masculinity seems to be not as religious as femininity.
How ironic then that women are denied in some traditions, certainly the Catholic tradition, or ordination to the priesthood.
Absolutely, it's one of the many conundrums, I tell you.
Well, a lot of conundrums about envy, and I thank you all so much for helping us have a look at it again. I think it's one of those things, as I said at the beginning, the most unhappy of the sins, the one we least like to admit even to ourselves. Steve Salerno, Joseph Gelfer, and Jackie Frank, thank you so much for being on The Spirit of Things with me.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Love does not envy, said St. Paul. But as you heard, it's not easy to escape the green-eyed monster, as Shakespeare called it. But maybe envy isn't always driven by such dark desires. As David Chapat experienced it, envy was a natural consequence of being deprived a normal life.
The sun shone through the Venetian blinds above my head as I awoke to the sounds of happy children playing outside in the street. I looked at the luminous numbers on the alarm clock sitting on my bedside table. It was only 6:03 a.m., and even though this was just a normal day to me, for the worldly people outside, it was Christmas morning. I crept out of my bedroom, careful as to not wake the rest of my family, making my way to the front lounge room window, which also doubled as my viewing panel of the outside world. Like so many times before, I grabbed one of the high-back suede chairs from the dining table and pushed it towards the windowsill, which then enabled me to climb aboard, pull the curtain back, to take in the activities of a normal suburban street in Narara, New South Wales. Keeping my head positioned low so I was not spotted, I watched in awe as the Turner kids from across the street and the adjoining houses, all still in their pyjamas, were joyously playing with and showing off their newly acquired Christmas presents. There were shiny BMX bikes, radio-controlled toys, Barbie dolls, and everything a normal child could dream of. My heart leapt with joy as my eyes darted from corner to corner of the window, watching the worldly kids enjoy their favourite day of the year, Christmas Day. Although my heart was happy for the children, a sense of discontent burned within my 10-year-old body. This was a scenario that I would never experience, and I wanted to be a part of this and every other fun thing that members of the outside world were experiencing. Little did I know, this would be the beginning of a childhood riddled with envy. Growing up on the central coast of New South Wales, as a member of the strict controversial sect, the Exclusive Brethren, I had no idea that I was so different from those of the outside world, or worldly people, as they were called until I started to integrate with them. A life spent attending church 5 nights a week, half-day Saturday and all-day Sunday, and a lifestyle void of so many things, had me envisaging as a young child that this was as good as it got. I had a loving family around me, but upon commencing primary school, I realised I'd hardly scratched the surface in regards to what the world had to offer. Here children experience Christmas presents, swimming pools, television and radio, birthday parties, computer games, weekend sports, movies, and countless other things. I constantly asked my parents why we were not allowed to partake in these pleasures of life that to me as a child seemed innocent. For a while I was placated by their answers that they were of the world and we were part of the chosen people to reap the rewards of eternal life. But as the years progressed and my worldly knowledge grew, these feelings of curiosity and intrigue turned to envy and finally resentment. I grew tired of watching my schoolmates eat lunch together, kiss a girl, attend a blue light disco, take a date to the movies, try their first cigarette, and attend parties. I was laughed at, mocked and jeered by my fellow peers for being different, and I longed to be a part of their lifestyle. It was not so much a feeling of jealousy as I was happy that they were experiencing and enjoying life, but more longings and desires that festered away inside as I led a life cocooned from society. I began slowly to build secret supplies of alcohol, pornographic magazines, pre-recorded tapes and Walkmans, sneaking out of home at night and attending parties to satisfy my desires to be part of a regular, normal world and to experience the pleasures of life that it offered. But all this resulted in was fueling my envy to a point where I decided that I had to make the ultimate sacrifice of all. It was either live a life of unhappiness with my family who I loved, or experience a life of freedom without the comfort of my loved ones around me. At 19 years of age, I chose the latter, and after some methodical planning, I escaped the confines of the exclusive brethren and entered the outside world with a bank book containing $15,000 and a backpack full of clothing. I was like a little child let loose within a candy store. Every desire that had been stamped out and every decision that had been made for me were all a thing of the past, as I was now able to freely make decisions for myself, regardless of the consequences. I decided to make up for lost time, throwing myself into every facet of life that had been kept from me as a child growing up. Whether this was going to work out, time would tell, but if I knew one thing, I wasn't going to die wondering. I experienced so many highs and lows after being locked away for so long. I turned to alcohol, womanizing and everything associated with a fast lifestyle. I faced near-death experiences as a police officer, the breakdown of relationships and a marriage, and the highs of experiencing the simple things of life that I'd been cruelly locked away from. In 2008, I even took part in the reality show Big Brother. Here I experienced the A-list lifestyle, where I appeared on television, walked red carpets with screaming fans, and received constant attention from attractive females, even from my peers at high school who had mocked me years earlier. The tables were turned, and people were now envious of my lifestyle that seemed out of their reach. Upon meeting the love of my life, I finally achieved perspective, clarity, and the satisfaction of a life that I had dreamt of as a child. And after a childhood spent envying everything around me and then experiencing every facet of life that I'd longed for, I can truly say that the time and effort wasted on being envious of others is far better utilized by enjoying the present and channeling all energy into getting the most out of this short life we have here on Earth.
David Chapat has written about his life in Breakout, How I Escaped from the Exclusive Brethren. Well, that's the program. We've got one last sin, the final straw. I mean the one between your teeth as you hang out in a hammock in the summer sun. Sloth. Does anyone have time for it? That's next month. Check out all our sins on our website at abc.net.au/rn/spiritofthings. And you can find a link to Pool there, where you can upload your creative responses to envy. Thanks to Stephen Tilley for sound engineering today. Next week, we're learning how to meditate for mental and spiritual health from two great experts, the medical guru of meditation, Dr. Jon Kabat-Zinn, and Brother Satyananda of the Self-Realization Fellowship. That's on The Spirit of Things with me, Rachel Kahn.
Is tinkering men in sheds with three-wheeled washing machines? Or is it open-source software? Can millions of online tinkerers save us from climate change? Is the digital age one big tinker? If you're a bottom-up or non-linear thinker and not a store-bought person, you most probably tinker. To change, to play, to improve. Future Tense wants your tales of tinkering. Details are at abc.net.au/rn/futuretense.